Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Welcome, Dress listeners, to an episode that has been on my mind actually for quite some time. 5 years to be exact.
Wow.
Since 2019, when I read Chief Fashion Critic for the New York Times, Vanessa Friedman's article entitled, Should These Clothes Be Saved? And in it, she highlighted this incredibly rare and incredibly special historic clothing collection that is housed at Smith College, which is a women's liberal arts college in Northampton, Massachusetts. And now you are probably wondering, if this collection is so rare and so special, what could possibly have prompted Vanessa to investigate if it was worth saving in the first place?
Well, the answer lies in what this collection is not: high fashion. Unlike more well-known collections, such as those housed in the Costume Institute at the Met or at the museum at FIT, which focus on collecting and exhibiting supreme examples of high fashion often worn by upper-class women, the Smith Historic Clothing Collection is exceptional among its contemporaries in that it values the everyday clothing worn by everyday women.
And we certainly know the value of this type of clothing on Dressed, but sadly, a lot of collecting institutions do not. And thus, these large chapters of women's dressed lives have overwhelmingly been written out of fashion history in favor of the clothing worn by an elite few. But it is exactly because these clothes in the Smith collection are ordinary that makes them extraordinary. This groundbreaking collection is comprised entirely of women's quotidian garments like aprons, uniforms, at-home dresses, sporting attire, and things like stains, alterations, mends are all valued in this collection as evidence of the daily toil and bustle of the wearer's life. And it is because these garments have lived sometimes multiple lives, they've been worn repeatedly, they're often repurposed, passed down, worn so much that they fall apart or become rags, it's because of this that they don't often survive. So to have 4,000 pieces in the Smith Historic Clothing Collection is absolutely incredible.
And largely a credit, it must be said, to one woman, Smith College theater professor and alum Kiki Smith, who first created the collection in the 1970s in an effort to preserve some interesting historic dress pieces that she discovered among discarded stage costumes. The collection has since grown in leaps and bounds over the years under Kiki's very thoughtful supervision, care, and curation. And remarkably, she still remains its loving steward to this day when she and the collection are finally getting the recognition they so deserve.
Yes, and we are so excited about this fact that we are dedicating both Dressed episodes this week to commemorating the collection's first ever exhibition, Real Clothes, Real Lives, 200 Years of What Women Wore, which recently opened at the New York Historical Society in New York City and is on view until June of 2025. And Kiki and Rebecca Shea are the exhibition's curators for the Smith College Historic Clothing Collection, and Anna Danziger-Halperin and Karen Binhorn, the curators for the Center for Women's History at the New York Historical Society. And if Karen's name sounds familiar, it is because she is a fellow fashion historian and past dressed guest.
And we are so pleased to welcome Kiki and Karen to the show to tell us all about this landmark exhibition. Kiki, Karen, welcome to Dressed.
Kiki, Karen, welcome to Dressed. It's so great to have you both here with me today.
Thank you
so much.
And before we dive into the specifics of the exhibition, Kiki, I am hoping that you can share the wonderful origin story of the Smith College Historic Clothing Collection that serves as the basis of this exhibition. How did this collection come to be, and can you give us an idea of what it's comprised of?
It came to be down here in the basement of the theater building here at Smith College, where I was as an undergraduate and then came back to teach. And when I came back, there was one large stock room, we call it, filled with costumes that could be used on stage. And I knew that there were pieces in there that had been sent by alumni and other people that were exquisite pieces that A, shouldn't be on the stage, and B, wouldn't survive on the stage. And they were all mixed and mingled in with Romeo and Juliet monks costumes and stuff. I pulled them out, realizing that they would probably be wonderful resources for my classes in costume design and for building clothes. It took about 15 seconds for the other students to realize what was in those closets and that they were of great interest. So I would bring some of them into class when we were looking at 19th century and early 20th century clothing. And there were always one or two students who were really wanted more information about it. Fortunately, in this area up here in the hinterlands of Western Massachusetts, there are several remarkable scholars on historic dress. I'm a costume designer. Yes, I study the history of dress, but there's infinite amounts for me to learn about. But with the help of other people in the area, we could really refine our understanding of it. In any case, there was one particular student. Instead of writing either an economics or Russian history thesis, which she was offered to do, she decided she wanted to set up this as a collection. And she set about to do it. And she consulted with Elizabeth Coleman, who at that point was at the Brooklyn Museum, and Stella Blum, who was at that point at the Costume Institute. She took her two favorite garments in a box with her. And these women were astounded, partly by this young woman who is remarkable. And they were really amazed at these pieces.
And this was Beth Walsh, right?
Yes. So she accrued a whole bunch of information, got it all organized, and got a very large grant to subsidize further student interns and to pay for these outside scholars so that I could learn along with the rest of the students. So that was back in the late 70s. And so gradually, I would realize, oh, there are more and more interesting things tucked in this costume storage area that ought to go into the collection. And every time a student would do a little exhibit based on one or two garments that she really liked, I would make sure that the college photographer came and would publish an image of it in the alumni information. And sure enough, alumni would write saying, oh my God, I'm emptying out my parents' attic and I have some clothes. Can I just send them to you? Sure. So we just kept building up. It's all by donation, everything that's here. And it just kept accruing more and more. And then more and more students became really invested in it. And thankfully, several of them, one of whom is my co-curator with Karen and with Anna on this exhibition. They're trained at FIT like Karen. And so they really know their stuff.
And is this Rebecca Shea?
Yes.
Yeah. She was one of my professors at FIT.
So you know.
Yeah. Yes. And that's really interesting, too, just learning about it being in the 70s, because for Karen and I, especially as fashion historians who've studied the history of our field, This is really early, right, in terms of valuing the clothes and the types of clothes specifically that are in this collection, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But people like Elizabeth Coleman, Stella Bloom that you just mentioned, these are really like pioneers in our field, as are you, in recognizing the value of this collection. So thank you so much. And we're going to learn all about it today.
I want to just add that the emphasis has grown from being exquisite pieces that people have donated that are beautiful. They not necessarily couture and what you'd find at the Brooklyn Museum or the MFA or the Met, which we could never compete with. And yet sometimes people would send in their maids' uniforms with all this stuff. And that kind of sparked this idea of nobody else is probably saving this. So it has evolved into having more and more emphasis on the ordinary woman, the 99% of us, as opposed to the ones wearing the exquisite pieces.
And that leads me right into my next question, which is that the exhibition title takes its name and inspiration from the book that you wrote by the same name, Real Clothes, Real Lives, 200 Years of What Women Wore. Can you talk a little bit more? You just referenced it, but what you mean by real clothes, real lives? Because in reality, all clothes that exist are real, but why does that connection really matter to you and what makes this collection so special?
When I was pulling garments out of the costume stock, I was pulling out what I called real clothes, not costumes. I always referred to them as these are real clothes, not things going on stage. Now, we put real clothes on stage too, but that was a moniker that I had for my own mind. And then it just made more sense because the clothes that became of interest to me and I felt could open up to students in a broad range of interests were the ones that would really open up the lives of real women and what the context is of their lives.
Yeah, and this is a collection that values things like a stain, right? A cigarette burn, a patch. Because these are all lenses and windows into the past, into these real women's lives. And Karen, I would love if you could actually put the significance of this collection into a wider context of typical museum collecting practices, because this collection is actually exceptionally rare, as is the collecting philosophy that supports it. So what sets the Smith Collection apart?
I think Kiki was very visionary in how she collected and chose those garments and accessories. Most museum collections would not collect something that is stained, it's patched, it's homemade, it's humble. Maybe it was bought from a Sears catalog, or it was worn by a maid or a waitress. It's not the kind of thing that museum collections usually collect. Usually museum collection are interested. Each museum has its own mission, but usually they're looking for the rare pieces, the very refined, the most exquisite examples of their kinds. And this is not this kind of collection. And today in academia, there is a lot of interest in everyday life, in everyday material culture. And I think in that sense, Kiki was decades ahead of her time in realizing these objects have stories that they can tell us that cannot be found in different kinds or in more kind of rarefied types of objects. And for us at the Center for Women's History, this fits exactly what we do. And it feels like such a great privilege to be the first museum to really showcase this collection in a big way, because at New York Historical Society, we have a saying, objects tell stories. And at the Center for Women's History, our mission is to even narrow that scope and look at what stories these objects can tell us about women's real lived experiences that we cannot see in other places. And we think about women's history in a very expansive way. So we think about non-binary individuals. We think about transgender people. It doesn't mean that we're doing a narrow history. It's just our lens and our way of bringing these stories that, similar to the everyday clothes, were not usually brought to the museum setting or were not intentionally collected, but you can find them in these archives, in these museum collections.
And we are here to talk about one such collection today, the Smith College Historic Clothing Collection, which is the foundation of this wonderful exhibition. Please introduce us to this exhibition, starting with how it came to be and what the New York Historical Society's role was in bringing it to life.
They were very instrumental. As a matter of fact, one major scholar, Lynn, who's worked with me for years, was close friends with Margie Hofer, who was a previous museum director, and was telling Margie about working on this book, which Lynn had done a great deal. And Margie perked right up and I guess must have contacted Karen and Valerie and Anna in their Women's History Gala and reached out. And it just feels, it's like the very best place. If we were going to show these pieces in New York, where else would it be better than there?
Yeah, and I want to add that when we started the conversation about having this exhibition, Kiki launched a book, and Anna Danziger Halperin, who's the associate director at the Center for Women's History, and myself, we saw Kiki on the stage, and the way that she was describing the clothes and the way that she was talking about how this collection came to be was really inspiring for us. And it became the way we were approaching how this exhibition would fit into our gallery. So one of the things that we have done, we worked with our designers, Sophia Lin and Kira Long, on how to interpret the fact that this is a study collection. How are we going to bring to life this idea that this collection is not just sealed in a basement, but rather is something that is used to teach new generations of curious people about how to read these clothes, and also the sort of this legacy of the collection as a unique collection that looks at everyday garments and objects. So one of the ways that we brought this to life was we had photographs. Some of them ended up in the book. Some did not end up in the book, but were taken in that process. And we annotate them as these big photo murals. So we're modeling to visitors how to read the garments, how to look at them, what are the details that are important to date them for the evolution of specific styles. Or we also have these annotations on the plexiglass in front of some of the garments. So we really are pointing visitors on how to look at this garment in a way that a fashion scholar would approach them. So that's one of the ways that we really give visitors the lens of this is not just a museum exhibition, this is a study collection. This is a way to tease out these real life stories of how women experience their everyday lives in the past 200 years.
And as the opening text of the exhibition tells us, quote, if we recognize everyday clothing from the past that has been overlooked, clothing created to be worn by real women living real lives, then we honor the lives of the women who wore it. So let's honor some of those women and their dress lives here today and take listeners through this exhibition, starting with the exhibition's first section, Home, All Work, No Pay. Can you please introduce us to this section and some of the home-specific items of clothing featured in it?
These are clothes that I find, well, it's like Sophie's Choice, which is my favorite. I can't say that. But I'm particularly fond of these clothes. These aren't the kind of pieces that would be saved. So the first piece that you see is a black and white calico work dress from the 1860s. And fortunately, the designers have blown up a wonderful daguerreotype of a black woman who was thought to be a washerwoman for the Union Army. She's holding a little U.S. flag in the image. She is dressed in almost the same garment, and it's all from about the same time. But the dress itself can suggest things like, was this woman perhaps a widow? The style of the black and white suggests it might have come out of her mourning. Or was it just a very practical piece of fabric because it doesn't show stains? It has no cuffs. It just has open sleeves, which she could push up her arm if she's in a wash tub. And then if you open it up, you see that it's been altered quite a bit. And I can only hypothesize, but it has grown in girth, let's just say. Maybe she put on weight, or maybe she was pregnant multiple times. And she could find a way to make it work, and we can find evidence of that with the scraps of calico she had to use on the inside. We don't know specifically who wore it, but we do know that this would have been a dress worn at home, probably with an apron over it, and she would not, if at all possible, have worn it out in public, out to go to the market. I wouldn't presumably be seen in my sweats that I would wear at home. You put a different garment on. But life was very formal at these times, and even someone without a lot of resources, which was probably this woman, she would still have a work dress that she wore and wore.
Something I really appreciate about this book, and this is passed on to the exhibition, is your careful study of the construction of the garments from the inside out, because you're revealing things to us that are not immediately visible to a discerning eye, and things like interiors that you just talked about. There's also a wonderful 1860s blue patterned short loose jacket that you take us inside of, likely repurposed from children's dresses, the lining, the calico. And it's just so wonderful to take us into these women's lives who are very creative with how they construct those exteriors that we don't necessarily get to see. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention is that things like, you just mentioned ease of movement, but something I found so fascinating about that dress you just mentioned is the wider sleeves. And you talk about how those are wider because they needed to be pushed up for work. And then it's accompanied by this wonderful photograph of this textile mill worker who has her sleeves pushed up. So yeah, just really incredible job taking us inside of the garments and these women's working lives.
I want to acknowledge the designers and Anna and Karen for helping to set up the way that blue work bodice is shown. You can really now look inside it, and there's a wonderful light. And it reveals a lot more than even if we just had it up on a form. It's really a wonderful way to show it.
It's a star object for sure. And one of the things, and Kiki mentioned again, the design was really important because it's sort of like a bridge for us. It's a visual way to really bring out all of these important details. We have very large labels that include images, interior shots of the garments, examples from real life of real women who were photographed in similar garments. And we also, one of the things that we've added to this exhibition is an audio guide, which is not your usual audio guide. In some cases, it's a zoom out and giving you context of a cluster of object or a specific object. But in the example of the calico, we actually have two separate audio stops for that garment. One of Kiki really describing in details how can we date this garment? What can we tell from the material object itself about the woman who might have made it, when she made it, when it was altered, most likely. But we also have an audio stop from Janie McKnight, who was our living history specialist at the New York Historical Society. And she speaks of the clothes of enslaved women, who some of them most likely wore something similar to that. So we really try to bring together the different expertise that we have, not just at the Center for Women's History, but across the museum, in order to interpret these objects for our audience.
And something that I think is done incredibly well is how the New York Historical Society plays a supporting role in really bringing these women's lives into further context. You have the garments, but you also have these wonderful images that can give people a visual accompaniment. And then, as you said, there's also this wonderful audio guide throughout that further enriches this visual narrative that you're telling through these clothes.
I just wanted to add that in addition to the audio and the images, also when we started working on the checklist for the exhibition, Anna and I started to mine both our library collection and our museum collection for objects that could supplement or complement some of those stories. So for the home section, for example, we have a cluster of sewing objects from the very fancy, very rarefied sewing box to a trade card that shows kind of middle-class women sewing together, but it's a very simple, very humble trade card that was probably given out in a dry goods store. We really tried thinking deeply about what are these objects that we have in our collection that would have been in the same setting or a similar one, or would have helped tell a visual story about the setting of these garments, the real life experiences of these garments and these women.
Absolutely. And you have a section, Keeping Clean, which is about laundry and the mess and labor of doing laundry, which, and I've been promising dress listeners a history of laundry because I think it's such a fascinating history. And I think today, with our modern conveniences, we don't really appreciate just how much labor went into keeping your garments and your family's garments clean, because women dedicated an entire day to it historically.
Yep. And that was just for the washing, never mind for the ironing. And that actually overlaps beautifully with our previous exhibition, which was women's work. So one of the things that we try to do here is also bring labor history. What do we recognize as work? If it's a domestic unpaid work, is it still work? Is it still labor? We know it is. So we really try to also bring that into the conversation.
And something, Kiki, that you mentioned earlier that I want to go back to is when you talked about how you wouldn't leave the house with your pajamas. Well, a lot of people actually do leave their house in their pajamas today.
That's true.
And that's because there's really been a breakdown in the sartorial codes that existed historically when there were really societally ingrained ideas about particular garments existing only in particular spaces in your life. So there was this idea of house clothes and the home being one of those spaces that had clothing reserved specifically for them. And something else that's featured in this section in the exhibition are wrappers, which are a garment that I absolutely adore, but is one that might not be as familiar to us today. Will one of you talk about the fantastic variety of wrappers you have in this section and maybe start with what that garment is?
I'll dive right in. It is the house dress, aside from the work dress of the black and white one that I talked about. This is a garment that women of most social classes, lower middle class, upper class, anyone living in a home where she's responsible for the upkeep, the children, getting them out to school, whatever, and particularly, say, not just even in an urban environment. This is the garment she'd put on first thing in the morning. And she might even wear it over a corset. She certainly would have a petticoat. But it's the private garment that she can go to the kitchen area, and if there is a cook, help give directions there. And it's utilitarian. It has no train, which means without picking up her skirts, she can, in theory, go up a set of stairs holding a baby and come down it holding a tray with utensils on it. The ones we have are cotton. They weren't always cotton, that are easy to launder and keep relatively clean. We have a bunch of them because it is a private world. It's also a garment that can be adaptable for pregnancy. And I think most of us have this notion about women when they were showing being pregnant, if they could be cloistered of sorts, they would be. And this would be a garment that she could wear around the house that she could leave somewhat unbuttoned and still cover herself up and be appropriately covered inside, particularly if friends, close friends are coming by to pay a call or something like that. She could, if she's ill up in her room, she could receive people there. It's an all-around utility dress that, in theory, you would not wear after noon. And by noon, change into better clothes.
Hence the term, your morning wrapper.
Exactly.
And then it kind of serves as the foundation for what will become the ubiquitous house dress, right, into the 20th century. I could talk about this section all day. I loved this section. There's so many fantastic pieces in it. And before we move on, just the house dresses that really become ubiquitous, manufactured inexpensively, really affordable for women, and printed in a variety of prints by the 1930s. You call it these invisible dresses because they're meant to be worn inside the home. But then you also really track that into almost the modern day, where there's still contemporary versions of them being sold on places like Etsy. But before we move on to the next section, I just want to highlight one woman in particular, because you do bring a face and a name to one woman in this section in particular, and that's Nell Donnelly Reed, who I had never heard of, and who is a woman entrepreneur, and who shows that you don't have to sacrifice style to price. Can you briefly talk about her and why she was significant to working women in the home?
Well, and she's somebody I didn't know about until I got this particular dress. So it is a Nellie Don label that she put into her clothes. She started off in the early part of the 20th century. She had an idea that women needed nicer clothes to wear at home with pockets. Thank you very much. And she managed to put together a couple of hundred and persuaded some store owner to let her sell them. They were gone almost instantaneously. Thus was born this business. She was an early millionaire. She was so good to her workers. During the Depression, they all worked, no matter what the demands were from the outside world. She made sure they got insurance. She was remarkable that way. So these are somewhat stylish, and they do match the basic form of contemporary stylish clothes, but made out of less expensive materials and easy to care for. So the phrase was that you would see in a department store, a Nellie Don, just try one on. She knew how to sell her clothes.
I think from a women's history perspective, this is one of my favorite objects because it really shows you how women use these gendered ideas about women having to be pretty, even at home, and feminine. But she took that and made it into a business, a very successful business. And then she uses her experience as a woman limited by her gender to then empower her workers and give them a living wage and give them the benefits and give them stability in their life. So this is, to me, this is like women's history in a garment.
There were approaches made to her workers to unionize, and they absolutely turned it down. They knew that the treatment they got was a very high level.
And especially for the 1930s, I think during the Great Depression as well, it's pretty remarkable. And she just might get her own dress mini set in the future, dress listeners, because she's really remarkable. And so we're going to move on from our first section and into the second section, which is service, capable and accomplished, which takes us out of women's private homes and into their jobs outside of it. And it highlights the uniforms that women wore to typical jobs available to them at the time. So gender-coded jobs, including things like waitress, domestic service, nurses. And I'm hoping you can highlight a few of the jobs and uniforms in this section. And maybe, Karen, we can start with you. What do they tell us about not just women's lives, but society at this time?
Absolutely. These service jobs are, I think about them as almost an in between the home and the public sphere. And in the space, when you walk in, it's that section between the public and the home for a reason. So these jobs took what was considered women's kind of natural skills into jobs that were paid jobs in contrast to the unpaid domestic work. We have three examples of jobs. It's waitresses, domestic workers, maids, and nurses. And for us at the Center for Women's History, it was really important to highlight that even though, and Kiki will talk about the garments themselves, the uniforms themselves, even though they have similarities in styles and details and construction, actually nurses are very different than maids and waitresses because nursing was required professionalized training, which was often when it started professionalizing in the 19th century, was not necessarily open to women who were not middle class and who were not white. So it was also seen as a more respectable, quote unquote, profession for middle class women who did want or needed to work outside the home.
Kiki, do you want to take us through some of the garments in this section?
Oh, some great favorites. Their waitress uniforms are a great favorite of mine. They're practical in a sense that I realized that the cotton ones, up until we move into the polyesters in the 60s and 70s, they were all able to be opened completely down either the front or the back so that you could wash them and put them on the ironing board and press them. We don't think about those necessities anymore. We don't really have to do them. And even the buttons on waitress uniforms and nurses' uniforms could be removed for some very serious scrubbing and then put back in again so you wouldn't break the buttons. I really appreciate Karen bringing up the connection. Women of color were denied any access for any variety of reasons, certainly to nursing. And occasionally they might get into some waitressing, but one of the only paid jobs that really was available to most women of color and to recent immigrant women was maids, domestic maids. And of course, easy exploitation of their time and their labor and hard work.
And we have an amazing object, the shoes that belong to Minnie, who was a maid on Long Island, and we're showing the bottom of the shoe and how worn out it was and as a whole. And you could really see the labor. You could really see how hard this work was and that these women didn't have a lot of clothes or a lot of shoes that they can just replace. They had to mend them, they had to fix them, and they just made do with what they had. And you can see the laces are broken, and it's quite amazing because you can really get a real sense of what it was like. And also another amazing object that we had is a maternity uniform for a McDonald's cashier. And you'll see across the exhibition, you'll see pregnant bodies several times. And this was really important to us because it's such an important experience. And it's not something that you often see in a museum display. And to see how over the years pregnancy was either concealed or shown or accommodated is really interesting.
I'll add another personal thanks to the museum. There are two books I stumbled upon that helped me enormously in researching this area. And they're both by Alice Kessler Harris, Out to Work and Women Who Work. If I hadn't had somehow found those books, I could never have gotten the depth of information. And lo and behold, she is one of the founders of this gallery, I think, isn't she? Or she's been a major advisor.
She is the chair of our advisory board.
See, yeah. I'm hoping to meet that woman.
You will.
She's a great hero of mine.
A women's labor historian. Her work has been very influential to what we do here. And actually, our previous exhibition that I mentioned, Women's Work, was inspired exactly by these books.
Yeah. And I mean, dress listeners, as Karen mentioned at the top of the episode, there's been a real shift. I mean, maybe since about the 80s, the 90s, but towards social histories and women's social histories. And then, of course, adding fashion history on top of that and using fashion history as a lens to look at women's labor historically. So this exhibition is in many ways scratching the surface or giving you an entry point into a really bigger, larger depth of knowledge. If you want to learn more, we can certainly provide links to these books in the show notes. And actually, dress listeners, this is where we are going to conclude today's conversation with Kiki and Karen, because there is oh so much more to say about this groundbreaking exhibition.
Kiki and Karen will be back with us on Friday to discuss the final three sections of the exhibition, which cover the modernization of women's fashion alongside women's lives, as well as the clothing intimately connected with different rites of passage in women's lives. We will conclude with the discussion of the final section in the exhibition, which is dedicated to those rebellious women who refuse to color and dress within the lines.
Yes, and you know how much we love them. And dress listeners, just a small note, we are already planning on taking you to see this exhibition in person in the early months of next year. So keep your eyes and ears open because we will be announcing our 2025 tour offerings in the coming months. But that does it for us today. And until Friday, may you consider coloring and dressing outside of the lines in your own life next time you get dressed.
Remember, we love hearing from you, so if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com, or you can also DM us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is, of course, where you'll find reels and posts accompanying each week's episodes.
And you can find the specific content linked to this week's episodes using the hashtags dressed514 and dressed515.
We get so many questions from you all about our recommendations for fashion history books. So if you're interested, you can always find a link in our show notes to our bookshop bookshelf. So that address is bookshop.org/shop/dressed. And there you can find over 150 of our favorite fashion history titles.
You can also find a link to that in our show notes, where you can find a link to dressedhistory.com, which of course is our website, where you can check out our latest offerings from the Dressed universe. That includes our classes and our tours. So head on over to dressedhistory.com and see what we have up our sleeves. Love Dressed but want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to our ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month and enjoy our 8 new episodes a month ad-free. That does it for us today, Dress listeners. Thank you as always for tuning in, and more Dress coming your way very soon. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media. Welcome, Dress listeners, to part two of our fascinating conversation with Kiki Smith and Karen Binhorn, co-curators of Real Clothes, Real Lives, 200 Years of What Women Wore. The groundbreaking exhibition currently on view at the New York Historical Society in New York City until June 2025.
You will remember from Wednesday's conversation that Kiki is the founder and curator of the Smith Historic Clothing Collection, the incredibly rare and special archive at the heart of this exhibition, which is the first to highlight this extraordinary collection comprised almost entirely of women's ordinary, everyday clothing. And as the exhibition's website tells us, quote, each piece of clothing holds rich stories about the woman who wore it and who made it, the materials used, and the context in place and time. Whether homemade or ready-made, many of the garments on display are modest and inexpensive, rarely saved or displayed in a museum setting.
So not typically the type of dress we are perhaps used to seeing on view in fashion-related exhibitions, but nonetheless valuable. And these clothes are actually, I would argue, more valuable because so much more of us can actually relate to them. And the stories sewn, and in this case worn, into the clothes we wear are the ones we love most to tell on Dressed. And this exhibition really brings these garments and their wearers to life for us across the exhibition's five sections that really demonstrate the crucial role that dress has played in women's lives throughout history and into today.
On Wednesday, we at the practical garments, we... What's that supposed to be? Discussed? On Wednesday, we discussed the practical garments worn by women to perform daily tasks within the home and the uniforms often worn by women in jobs outside of it. Today's conversation begins with the exhibit's third section, Public Dress in Good Taste, which shows how women of all social classes strove to follow society's written and unwritten dress codes.
Yes, and I was actually so pleased to see this exhibition, to see this section in the exhibition, because this is something I am constantly addressing on The Art of Dress, because every time I post footage from, say, the 40s or the 50s, inevitably there are so many people that will comment that, you know, people, quote, dressed so much better back then, etc. But I don't think a lot of people realize that that there were these often unwritten but well-understood dress codes or sartorial. Dress listeners, we know from experience that getting started investing can feel confusing. Especially with so many options out there, many people tend to put it off. But it does not need to be intimidating.
Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. And you don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you.
Acorns offers a learning platform for anyone wanting to learn more about investing strategies and also offers ESG portfolios, which invest your money in companies rated for their impact on environment, social, and governance issues, something that you know we love on Dressed.
So what are you waiting for? Head to acorns.com/dressed or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing in your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/dressed.
Dress listeners, it goes without saying that a lot of our shopping errands are made easier these days by shopping online. So why aren't you using Rakuten? Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop.
That's right. You can earn cash back when you shop at 3,500 stores for fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, concert tickets, and more. How does it work, you ask? Well, brands pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and this is passed along to you as cash back.
From Sephora to Petco and Levi's to Expedia, when you shop with Rakuten, your cash back can be deposited directly into your PayPal account, or they will send you a check. Membership is free, and you can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons.
If you're already shopping at your favorite stores, why not save while you're doing it? Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million users who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up. Ladies, are you finding yourself a bit off or experiencing cravings or bloating? Well, these are potential symptoms of PMS or menopause, and Hormone Harmony is here to help.
Hormone Harmony is capsule-based and contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body to adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's truly become a phenomenon. With 17,000 reviews, a bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds.
You too can join the more than 2 million happy Hormone Harmony customers. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today. Imperial contracts that really dominated the 19th and 20th centuries that most men and women across the social strata strove to abide by. And that is how intimately connected the clothes you wore, what the clothes one wore was with concepts of morality and respectability. And these dress codes aren't entirely gone today, but they have relaxed quite a bit.
Yes. And it also depends on where you are in the world, because I'm in Paris right now, and I have to say, I ran to the grocery store in really cute, like, zebra leggings and, like, a really cute sweatshirt the other day. And then I was only a few blocks from home, and I was like, oh, no, this is so American of me right now. I have to go back home and put on actual real clothes.
Yes, some things have changed and some have not. So let's jump back into my conversation with Kiki and Karen and learn more about those sartorial codes from the past. And then I'm just redoing this intro real quick.
Yeah.
Karen, can you talk about the written and unwritten rules for public dressing that are covered in the exhibit's third section? And specifically, I'm hoping you can speak about how they are exemplified by hat and glove culture, This is not necessarily something people are familiar with today.
Outro. Kiki, Karen, thank you so much for taking us behind the scenes of this incredible exhibition. Cass, what a reminder about the significance of the clothes we wear in our everyday lives.
Yes, absolutely. And this collection and exhibition are truly so special and such a beautiful tribute to women and specifically to Kiki herself as well. And I just want to give her a special shout out because none of this would have been possible without her. It was she who, oh, so many decades ago, really first recognized the value of these clothes to begin with. And she was incredibly instrumental in establishing this women-focused collecting mission and really stewarding this collection for all of us to enjoy into the present day and well into the future.
And you have until June of 2025 to catch this exhibition in person, dress listeners. And you are also very soon going to have the option to visit in person. I cannot talk today. I'm out of practice. You will also have until June of 2025 to catch this exhibition in person, dress listeners. And you're also very soon going to have the option to visit it in person with us early next year as part of our New York City Day Tour offerings. So keep your eyes and ears open for that. And if you can't visit in person, do not worry, because you can get your hands on a copy of Kiki's absolutely fantastic book highlighting the collection from which the exhibition took its name, Real Clothes, Real Lives, 200 Years of What Women Wore. You'll find a link to all of these things and more in our bio.
Oh, sorry, in our show notes.
I was wondering about that. I was like, what? Did we change things? You will find a link to all of these things and more in our show notes.
Well, that does it for us today, dress listeners. May you consider the ways that you and the clothes you wear are history in the making next time you get dressed.
Boop, boop.
Okay, we just got a message that there's an issue with the Rakuten audio. So something, as I mentioned earlier, that I'm always talking about on my Instagram, because I post these historical videos and people really are complaining, I have to say, about the breakdowns in societal dress codes. And I try to explain that there were historically for a very long time these unwritten but well understood societal dress codes or sartorial contracts that dominated the 19th and most of the 20th centuries, and men and women across the social strata strove to abide by them because that is how intimately connected it was to the way, that is how intimately connected the way you dressed was with broader societal ideas of not just gender, but morality, respectability. And so I was very pleased to see this addressed and explained in the exhibit's third section, which is public dress and good taste. Can you talk about these dress codes, Karen, specifically as they're exemplified by hat and glove culture? Because this is not necessarily familiar to us today. And then, Kiki, you can highlight some of the objects in this section.
Yeah, definitely. It really shows how women historically had to trade very carefully when they ventured out in public. Not too much and not too little, and be exactly what society expects of you, and how scrutinized they were when they did go out in public. And one of my favorite little kind of vignettes that we have is this, I call it the glove cluster. And this is based on research of another team member of ours, Jean Gutierrez, who found this really rich history of women wearing gloves in our library and museum collections. And now it's like a forgotten thing to go out with gloves. And there is actually, to those who watched Capote versus the Swans, there is a beautiful scene where they go to a department store and they find that the gloves department has closed. And it really signifies the end of an era. So up to the 1960s, women went out in public wearing gloves covering their hands. So we pulled a few very, very interesting objects that show how this was an everyday thing for women, especially middle class elite women, but also aspiring women who needed to look respectable, whether it was a shop girl or an actual middle class woman going out. So we have a glove buttoner, a glove hook, all of these little accessories that you needed to sustain this everyday practice. And gloves tended to be very tight, so you really needed all of those things, a glove stretcher, objects that would not be recognizable to people today, but were everyday objects in the 19th century.
And another thing that we pulled, because we always want to show this spectrum of experiences from working class women or women to all the way around the social spectrum. So we bring this story of Agnes Nestor, who was working as a glove manufacturer in a factory making gloves. And she actually goes to become a labor activist and really advocating for women who were working these low paid jobs, manufacturing gloves for middle class women, and how their activism is helping workers get better pay, better working hours, better working conditions. And so we bring within this kind of object that we see as a middle class object, but we try to really give you a sense that not just the person who was wearing it, but who was making it, who was making these luxury items, even if they were everyday items, who is behind, whose labor is sustaining this social practice?
Who makes the your invisible clothes?
Makes your clothes, exactly.
Yeah, and I was going to say glove and hat culture, as you just referenced, created tons of jobs, especially for young women. But something Absolutely. That you make clear in this section, and as you refer to with Agnes Nestor, is that even as technology advances to support these advancing dress codes, glove and hat culture, and make more and more products affordable to more and more people, regardless of class, and again, this is something we very much still deal with today, this comes at a cost. Can you talk a little bit more about what that cost is?
Karen, go ahead. You want me to do it? Yeah, of course. Yeah, so we see it across 200 years. We see anything from women going in the 1980s as women are starting to have more office jobs, middle-class women who until then, when they got married and started a family, would retreat back to family life. In the 1980s, it became more acceptable for them to go out and work. But then as they do that, now they're scrutinized. Once again, they're in male-dominated environments. And we have this really beautiful example. We have by John T. Malloy, who sensed towards the end of the 1970s that women who started to work in these male-dominated environments, in these offices, in executive jobs, that they really struggled to be accepted, to have authority over employees. And he conducted hundreds of interviews, was self-titled a wardrobe engineer. And he came up based on these interviews with this formula of how women should dress in an office, which was essentially a pantsuit, masculine in very dark colors, but with a feminine touch. So you don't want to be too masculine because then you're going to be not respected or seem to infringe too much on the masculine sphere or your colleagues. But if you are too sexy, then that is perceived as being unprofessional. So he was creating this formula that we see by the 1980s is what women are wearing when they are going out to work in offices. But then next to that, we have an example from Diane von Furstenberg, iconic wrap dress. And what she is saying is that I can be a successfully professional woman and still be sexy. And I really love that contrast between these two approaches, because it really distills the cost of women going out in public, having these jobs, changing the path of their lives, making these social changes, but there's always a backlash. There's always a social backlash, and how do they deal with that? That is, to me, a really interesting story that is told through what women choose to wear when they go out. How do they present themselves? And that there is more than one way to do it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And how that competes with societal ideals of what they should look like too, right?
Exactly.
Which is super interesting.
Exactly. I want to point out that
this weekend, Vanessa Friedman in the New York Times wrote about the so-called pussy bow blouse, which had been one of the emblematic shirt blouses that John Malloy mentioned as being a feminine way of dressing in your suit. And we still have it. And the question was, why is it called that still? And there's Kamala Harris wearing a version of it in one of her recent shows. So there are elements of how women can afford to dress in a uniform, I'm putting in air quotes, that is both authoritarian and not too much.
Yeah, it's, don't take it too far.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, I just taught a 2-part, 8-class course on what women wore to the revolution. And really one of the driving themes is that exchange between what women put on their bodies and society's ideas, right? Societal ideals of what it means to be a woman and how you should look, right? And then how women are constantly fighting that, beginning in the 1850s with women suffragists, right? Daring to wear male-coded garments. So the role that gender plays in our dressed body very much continues up into the modern day. And sorry, I lost my train of thought. Oh, we're still in the third section. Okay. And something else I wanted to point out is that the clothing we have discussed so far embodies a lot. Sorry, let me redo that. And something else I also talk about in that class is pointing out that the clothing that we have discussed. Sorry. By the way, Kiki, I'm the editor of this podcast. So if you ever want to say anything over again, you can.
Thank you. Okay.
And something I also want to point out is that the clothing we have discussed so far embodies a lot of the tenets of so-called modern fashion, right? So clothing that is comfortable, supported by women's natural body, it's easy to move in, it's practical, utilitarian, and that traditional narratives might associate with high fashion and more upper-class women, right? So Chanel in the 1920s and so on. But it's really important to acknowledge that these groundbreaking tenets of modern fashion that women's mainstream fashion is working towards for the first 6 decades of the 20th century is rooted in women, working women's clothing out of necessity. And these women really deserve the credit for pushing fashion into modernity because they demanded it, right? They needed, they were really wearing it first. So I think this section, is also really significant, and it demonstrates how the modernization of women's fashion throughout the 20th century is also connected to the modernization of women's lives and their place in society, or at least they're in conversation with one another. They're really intimately connected during this period. Can you take us through this evolution using objects in this section? Because I think you do a really beautiful job of telling that story.
I'm going to give a try. I was just thinking there.
Oh.
It's a...
Oh, you got... Well, Kiki, I'm sorry. You were frozen for the first part.
For a second. Start over.
If you just want to start over.
Yeah. I'll give it a try. I like to refer to a suit that's in the public section of the exhibition. In the book, we put it in with the service area because it was adapted and used by a group of women who happened to be Smith alums who went to France during World War I in order to provide support to try to improve the living conditions of the people caught in the middle of the trench warfare up in northern France. And the garment that we have is actually a suit. It has an Abercrombie and Fitch label in it, which was up till that time purely just men's sportswear, but they were starting to expand a little bit. And it was worn by one of these Smith alums who went over there, and it has a badge on it that is from this group of the Smith College Relief Unit. But the feature about it is that I've seen almost exactly that same suit in a Sears catalog of the same time. So it was an adaptation, in effect, of men's uniforms of what?
Oh, no. That college basement internet.
Uh-oh. Am I on yet?
Yes.
We're on now, yeah.
Okay. Maybe I'll get Karen to speak up, and hopefully this will resolve itself. But I was just trying to talk about this suit in this section that is was used by a woman to help in a volunteer group going to France during World War I. And she is wearing basically a suit that could have been worn by any woman, but that has so many connections to the actual men's army uniforms from the time. So there's also an adaptation of taking some elements of men's clothes, making them into women's garments that are useful and appropriate. And also the hems are getting shorter so that she really could do the work that she was required to do. So that's one thought that comes to mind. Karen, you may have other.
Yeah, and I wanted to add with that suit, it's also uncorseted, right? She's not wearing it over a corset. And as I'm also a fashion historian, and a lot of my work is rooted in the body and thinking about how the clothes and the body work together. And we, next to that suit, we have a day dress from around the same time period. And in between, we have an example from our library collection of a paper doll from around kind of 1915-17. And you can really see how what's cool about this paper doll, I should say, is that you could see both the undergarments and the clothes that she would wear outside, right? So you could see the body and what happens to the body during that time period. And part of it is from this need to be more active and more in the world and having these new roles that, unfortunately, wars did allow women to have to occupy roles that they were not able to do before. The suit of the ambulance driver that we have that Kiki mentioned is one of them. So World War I really opens up opportunities for women to be nurses, to be ambulance drivers, to do relief work, to go out over enemy lines, to do all of these things that they couldn't do before the war. And it's really hard to put that back, to bottle back after the war. So you can see how the wardrobe changes, how what women expect from their everyday clothes to be more comfortable, to be less rigid, to limit them less. And we can really see that evolution.
Yeah, and I think the war dynamic's really important to understanding that, too, because it's allowed by society, right? The women's rights activists of the 1850s get all this pushback from society. This is a male garment you're trying to adopt, et cetera. And it's also linked to the women's right to vote. But during the war, women are public facing in a way in the millions, in a way they just haven't been before. And so a lot of those societal restrictions around dress relax because they have to. And that continues in the post-war era. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily realize that because we associate modern fashion with the 1920s, but it really comes at the hands of these women. What were you going to say, Kiki?
I was just going to pick up on another dress. It actually two pieces side by side. One of them is a polyester double knit.
Man.
Yeah. But until that time. But I was so happy to get this garment to make sure that it was, we are also aware that there are women with different body shapes and who could be accommodated in elegant clothes. And next to that is a polyester knit, I don't think it's a double knit, pantsuit, which, of course, was revolutionary in its own way, the idea of women wearing pants. Rebecca, my colleague in this, was sitting next to a now retired, very high-end lawyer, a corporate lawyer, who, when Rebecca asked her if she ever wore pants to work, she said, absolutely not. She was wearing stockings until she retired. And she said once she wore a very high-end pants outfit to a Saturday meeting. And one of the lawyers came up to her and said, getting dressed to go to a ball game? So there she was just caught. So anyway, there are all these pushing elements, pushing out the idea of women's body shapes and the roles that they can play. Some of them through war and some of them through underwar.
Yeah, and you're talking about that fantastic rust pantsuit from Wranglers in the 70s. And what was the first garment? You cut out a little bit in the first polyester garment. Can you just tell us a little bit about that real quick before?
It's a polyester.
Dang it.
It's a Len Bryant.
It's a Lane Bryant.
Okay, dress. Will you just say that one more time for me? A Lane Bryant.
It's a polyester double knit Lane Bryant skimmer dress, I think it was referred to. An A-shaped, loose, softly fitted dress from the late 60s, early 70s. And it's got little polyester double knit paisley, very hip. This is the generation.
And then moving into the fourth section of the exhibition, which is Rites of Passage, What She Wore, is all about the important role that clothing plays in marking significant events in women's lives and how those meanings have changed over time. Can you please highlight this section for us and some of the garments featured within it?
I'll give it a try and hope that I don't cut out. Let's see, there's a range. There's kind of the idea from birth to death. We have other areas where there are maternity clothes, not specifically in this particular gathering here at the museum exhibit. And there are some mourning accoutrements, hats, black crepe wrapped hats and little bonnets, and mourning jewelry that's both from Smith and New York Historical Society. There's a blow-up photograph of three brides' dresses from the first 4 years of 1970s. And one of them is a kind of baby doll long dress and up to the neck and really sweet. One of them is a micro mini little dress that was made in Mexico. And one of them is a long knit skirt with a white cashmere top. And each of those brides was very different and married in a very different kind of way. And it, to me, I love the variety that these young brides were exploring for their gathering. But even more to me is one of the Cancionera dresses. There, we have two in the collection, and the first one will be in this phase one. It's a beautiful piece from about 2019, very recently, from the daughter of...
Ew.
Come on.
We see you now.
Okay. The young girl chose a very fancy red short dress, and which surprised me. And she insisted on wearing Converse sneakers with it, not heels. Well, the world has really changed, it seemed to me, if she could do that.
Yeah, and we should say that part of the Cancioniera ceremony is changing from flats to heels during the ceremony to symbolize this transition from girlhood into womanhood. And she really defies that with just going with sneakers, and her entire family also, in tribute to her, wore these white sneakers as well. With the bride's outfits that Kiki mentioned, these are untraditional choices for a bride. And we really also wanted to bring out like what a traditional bride would have looked like. And we have across our library collections a lot of paper dolls that we love. And we love paper dolls because we have a lot of different visitors moving through our space. And we have a lot of school groups with kids. And kids do love toys and games. And it's something that really speaks to them. So we found this beautiful series from the 19th century that depicts a traditional wedding. So wow. We have a little bride and a little bridesmaid. And it's very cute because you can open it up and see the undergarments of the period as well underneath. So it's another opportunity for us to show what was worn under, what's under these fancy little dresses. And as Kiki mentioned, the mourning jewelry and the 19th century, we talked about this like how going out in public was a space where women were really scrutinized, really, they had to put up to have a face when they were going outside. And unlike today, when grief is a very personal process, in the 19th century, it's a very public thing. So women are expected to follow very strict rules of what to wear, what colors to wear, when. And we show that through these beautiful accessories, some super fancy, made of human hair, and some more humble, but also have human hair. So we're showing this kind of range that it wasn't just a middle class or elite practice. And at the same time, I mentioned the audio guide that we have here. It was a really interesting opportunity for us to highlight how fashion becomes, how black becomes a fashion color. And what happens between the 19th century, which when it's a work or mourning practice color, to being considered the most chic, the height of fashion color. And my interpretation of it, that it goes through, again, the story of women workers and these women working in department stores in the 19th century, wearing black head to toe, and they become like this symbol of new, of kind of like consumerist culture of modernism. They're seen as themselves almost like glamorized objects that you can quote unquote purchase as well. But these women are being glamorized in artworks, mm-hmm. in magazines, and that head to toe black, which is also very practical, as Kiki mentioned. As we go into the 20th century, when people are looking for more practical, modern way of dressing, that becomes like the chic way to dress both for evening and every day.
Yeah, again, so busting those 1920s Chanel myths.
Absolutely.
Right? The idea that the little black dress comes into fashion in the 1920s, right? It's really all a fashion history if you look at it. Is all part of this, these longer narratives. You really can trace so many things back to working women, as you just demonstrated. And our listeners are familiar with us with it too, because we talk about it just in terms of World War One, the role World War One had also in breaking down these larger mourning practices as like a cultural public thing, because so many people died during that war, right? So that culture really dissolves during World War One and after World War One. When black becomes, continues to become a fashion staple adopted across the social strata. That's super fascinating. Thank you, Karen. And then something also that I think is a running narrative throughout this, and something else that is a running narrative throughout this exhibition is the changing, sorry. And this is emblematic of these running narratives throughout, of this running narrative throughout the exhibition, which is the changing societal values. And that's, this is exhibited in life and also the material culture. One of my favorite pieces in this section is Eileen Hernandez's Sweet 16 Sugar Cube corsage. Can you all just talk about that? Because I think that's something that we're not familiar with today, but I just found so fascinating.
I'm going to speak up, if I may. Eileen Hernandez, I did not know who she was, but she was very involved in the National Organization of Women. But before that, she had major jobs in Washington, some of which she quit because they were so frustrating. And she gave her papers to Smith, to the archives here. So the papers arrived, I understand, and there was wrapped up in tissue paper this clump of ribbons and sugar, which the archivists thought, we can't have sugar in here. There happened to be a student of mine who was there at the time and said, could I take these to Kiki? And she did, and we both looked at it, and then I counted up the number of sugar cubes. There happened to be 16. I had no clue, but I finally found that there was this tradition of young girls getting corsages at different stages of their lives, and this was the one for the Sweet 16. And somehow, the idea that this woman who was so strong in the world of unions, in the world of women's work, in the world of National Organization of Women, saved her Sweet 16 corsage
was particularly a dear story.
Don't know exactly why.
And I'll add that Aline Hernandez, we've featured her in other exhibition at the center. She was a very important laborer, organizer, and activist, worked at the Garments Union, part of NOW, of course. And we actually have, and I should say that her corsage will be part of the second phase of the exhibition. It's going to be encased because we, too, don't normally include actual sugar in our exhibitions. But we did find archival audio of hers, not specifically talking about this, but more generally talking about her positioning as a woman in kind of labor activism. And I thought such a great tie-in between the Smith Collection and what we do anyway at the Center for Women's History and how it comes together in this sweet object, but really worn by this fierce person who worked so hard for women's labor to be recognized, and the different difficulties that women from different backgrounds have, that it's not just your challenges as a woman, but as a woman of color or a working class woman.
And this segues perfectly into the final section in the exhibit, which is also my favorite. I guess they're all my favorite. This is a fantastic exhibition. Congratulations,
you know this, by the way.
Which is Pushing the Boundaries Rebel Wear. So this section is dedicated to all the badass ladies who dare to, quote, defy, challenge, and surpass the restrictive boundaries set by society, a running theme throughout our conversation today. And running theme, obviously, throughout the entire exhibition, but really gets focused in here. And of course, we're all indebted to these women today. And I'd love if you can introduce us to some of these rebellious women, the rebellious clothes, and these women who, quote, refuse to be sweet or ladylike, and in doing so, quote, expose the arbitrary boundaries of gender with their bodies.
I'm going to jump in with the last of the four garments that are currently up there. It's a Eddie Bauer, black.
Well, that's done.
Oh, you cut out. Okay.
Am I back?
You're back.
Okay. So there's this black down coat worn by a very tiny woman. So she must have been swathed up in it. She was at the time about 94, 95. She lived here locally in Northampton, but was renowned as an anti-war activist. And indeed, one of the pieces that she wears that we've draped over it is a poncho made out of red, shiny red plastic vinyl on which she had painted, "We support your right to say no." And it was in reference to during the Vietnam War, to war protesters. Now, this is a woman who fought all her life for principles about that, about anti-nuclear war, and a range of others. And she died at the age of 100. And forest that was due to be cut down for
Kiki, you cut out. You cut out right when you said, and she died at 100.
So Frances died at 100, but not too long after she'd already been arrested in a woods in Massachusetts, where she and a group of people were protesting the intrusion of a huge gas transport through a natural woods area. And at some point early on in her life, she was asked, "How many times, Mrs. Crow, have you been arrested?" And her answer is, "Never enough." This is a very perky person.
And Karen, do you have any favorite objects or people featured in this section?
I have to say, this is also my favorite section because it overlaps so much with what I do
both at the center, but also in my own work outside of New York Historical Society. I have several favorite in this, but there's one kind of little vignette that I really love. It's the Afrocombs. And we pair that with a photograph from our collection by Upper West Side photographer, actually, Johnny Laurie, who in the 1970s walked around Central Park. Bethesda Fountain at the time was this place where people would come to be seen, like the runway, the New York runway of the time. And we include a photograph of these young women sporting these really beautiful afros and this huge heeled 70s shoes, as you can imagine them. And it, actually, this vignette, it's almost one of the only places where you'll see celebrity faces. So we have on the label these references of women who made the Afro popular, Miriam Makeba and Angela Davis. So we also wanted to ground it in the political work of women during that time period. And I really wanted to feature another kind of archive audio to really bring that to real experience. And I searched everywhere. I listened to every possible oral history. And at the end, I found this amazing clip from a SNCC organizer, Karen Spellman, where she describes how she transitioned into wearing her naturally curly, and how with that actually then come the political activism, the Black consciousness, this idea that Black is beautiful. It's not just a visual thing. It's a political statement. And it was so fascinating to me to hear it in her own words, describing not that the politics led to her wearing her hair naturally, but it was the other way around, that her body in public, her the way she dressed, the way she did her hair, that led to her political consciousness. And that was so beautiful to me. And I felt so privileged to be able to include that in the exhibition.
Yeah. And for our listeners who might not know, when you said SNCC, you meant SNCC is short for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And this section reminds me a lot of the work of Tanisha Ford and her book, Liberated Threads. And Tanisha, of course, has been a guest on the podcast. And she talks about, in that book, she talks about her mom being a college student in the either late 1960s or 1970s. And again, the intersection of all of politics and dress in the 1960s specifically is really fascinating. And he did an excellent job bringing that to light in this section.
Yeah. And we actually are going to have a program with Tanisha on December 3rd, alongside Michelle McVicker, who's historian of Latinx material culture, who did an audio stop for our quinceañera dress. So we're going to put them in conversation and talk about fashion in political movements.
Amazing.
I want to hear about that. So I want to be there.
Yeah, you'll have to send me maybe I can get it from Mary Beth, but the list of programming, because I can mention that in the outro to today's episode.
Absolutely.
Okay, you both have been so generous with your time. I, for one, know I am super excited to see this exhibition. I know our dress listeners are, and we have so much time. We have until June of next year. And just in closing, Kiki, Karen, what do you ultimately hope people are going to take away from this exhibition?
I'm going to add a comment that was reported to me by my friend Rebecca, gave a copy of the book to her neighbor. And her neighbor thanked her and reported that she and her sister, they are both school librarians, were reading it out loud to each other. And her sister paused and said, "No, I didn't know we were part of history." But that's what I want all of us to know. We all are part of history, and all of our stories are valuable and important to pass along. I really love that, because at the Center for Women's History, we really love to leave, for visitors to leave with a reflection. And so we tend to finish our exhibitions with a little reflection prompt. And for this one, we're asking people to reflect about what do their clothes say about their own lives? And that's what I hope people will take away, that they would leave this space thinking about more deeply about what their clothes say about them. But also, because I'm a fashion historian and I'm like obsessed with the stories that these clothes and adornment can tell us, I also hope that people will take some of that away when they leave the gallery, that we can really tease out these real life stories from these garments.
You've certainly achieved that. Thank you both so much for being here, and I can't wait to see the exhibit.
Thank you, Cassidy.
Thank you.
Okay, we did it. Thank you both so much. This is obviously a two-parter. It's going to come out in a couple weeks. The exhibit opens next week, right?
Yes.
Oh, this week, Friday.
Oh, Friday. Okay. Congratulations, and thank you both. Karen, are you able to stay on for a minute?
Yes.
So we can just catch up briefly. Kiki, it was such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to both.
Bye, Kiki. And Kiki, I need to send you, I forgot to sign you on a release form for the audio.
Okay.
Oh, that's fine.
Great.
Okay. Recording stopped.
Bye. Hello. I just wanted to say hi.
How are you?
I'm good, Harry.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.